What do we want?
Real democracy.
When do we want it?
Now. What do we want?
Real democracy.
When do we want it?
Now.
Welcome to Real Democracy Now. I'm Nevek Thompson, and Real Democracy Now is a podcast for people who think we can and should improve how democracy works. This podcast looks at democracy from different angles to help you think about how democracy might be improved. Welcome to Episode 7 in Season 3 of Real Democracy Now, a podcast. In this episode, I'm talking with Anthony Green about the Australian electoral system and Vote Compass, a tool which allows voters to explore how their views align with the major parties. Anthony Green is an Australian cephologist and commentator. He is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's election analyst, as well as being an adjunct professor at the University of Sydney in the School of Social and Political Sciences. Thanks so much for joining me today, Anthony. You're very well known here in Australia, and you're known to be the election analyst and commentator. And I'm just interested to know how you came to be working in the field.
Partly by chance. I'd originally done a maths computing degree, a science degree after school, and worked in the computer industry for a while and got a bit bored. And I went back to university and did an economics degree majoring in politics in the mid-80s. And I was sort of hunting around for what to do next, doing some postgraduate studies in econometrics, probably ending up in that area, and was hanging around for a job, and I was back in the computer industry again. And I saw this job ad for a six-month job at the ABC as an election researcher to work on the 1990 federal election. The main task was just to do a book of notes for all the presenters and do everything else in the background that was required. But I think what they really were taken by was that I had so much more computer experience than any other of the people who applied. I mean, lots of people applied who worked for parties or PhDs in politics and the like, but I was the only one who had this peculiar crossover of a background in computing as well. And so they hired me for a six-month job that would have been finished a month after the 1990 federal election, except all the main presenters, Andrew Wiley, Paul Lynham, Kerry O'Brien, all insisted I should be re-employed because I knew what he was talking about, they all said. And then they gave me the job of designing their computer system, which I did. I designed the basic database, maths, how it all adds up and works in the background. And in the meantime, did some work on redistributions, and someone interviewed me one day on camera and thought, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about, and he just went from there. So right place, right time, right skills, and making the most of the opportunity I got, and I've turned it into a career.
That's interesting, isn't it, how different careers can just kick off 6 months. Yeah, it's always good to take a six-month job. You can never know where it can lead. So
my initial thought was I can always go back to economics, and I never needed to.
Yeah, that's great. All right. So just wondered if you could provide a brief overview of how the Australian electoral system operates, and I'm thinking there at a national level, and perhaps identify any key differences that exist at a state level.
I think if you did a broad outline of what defines Australian politics, there's several institutions which define it. One of them is compulsory voting. You must vote at Australian elections. It's compulsory registration and compulsory voting. There is a small fine if you don't vote, but it's very easy to vote. And it's often been said that it's easier to vote in Australia than to not vote. If you don't vote, you have to deal with fine notices and the like. And so compulsory voting adds a huge stability to Australian politics. You don't see wild swings and roundabouts that you see in other countries, which can be created by turnout effects of an unpopular government whose supporters don't turn out. In Australia, they still all turn out, so you don't tend to get the wipeouts of parties that occurs in other countries. You do occasionally get them in Australia, but I think the key thing you would notice about voting patterns in Australia is their stability, is that people who don't have a lot of interest still tend to have an underlying affiliation with one party or the other. The second thing to say is that all Australian elections, at state, territory, and at most national and at most local government elections, are made using what we call preferential voting, the alternative vote, some people call it, or ranked order preferencing, instant runoff elections. When you vote in Australia, you number the candidates on the ballot paper. And if nobody reaches 50% of the vote on first preferences, the lower order candidates get excluded and their ballot papers re-examined, and you come up to a final count where somebody has more than 50% of the vote. Now, that's compulsory in most parts of Australia. The preferences, you must number all the squares. And there's also, in some states, it's optional. You don't have to number every square. In terms of parliamentary institutions, most Australian parliaments, both state and federal, are bicameral. There's an upper house and a lower house. And the convention that's developed over decades is usually the lower house is single-member electorates with preferential voting, and the upper houses are what's called the single transferable vote, which is a form of preferential voting in multi-member electorates. So that you get differential majorities. You often get majority governments in the lower house that don't control upper houses, and we have quite strong upper houses in Australia at both state and federal level. So to me, they're the three institutions you would define. One of the oddities, compared to countries like Canada and the United States, which are also federations, is while Australia is a federation of six states, there's very little difference in the voting patterns from state to state. Our national parties exist in every state, and they tend to have, they are competitive in every state as well. Our two major parties, certainly the Liberal and the Labor Party. So there isn't a lot of between region, between state differences. Like if you go to Canada, there's massive differences between the party structures in the provinces compared to federally. That doesn't apply in Australia. And it's quite peculiar. And we also have this upper and lower house structure, which means that people get two votes in most states on election day. There isn't an awful lot of difference in the voting patterns between the two houses, but the different electoral systems mean very different outcomes develop. But if I had to pin down the two things, I would say, and now the unique features of Australian electoral systems, compulsory voting and preferential voting, they make quite a difference to the way politics is conducted.
That's really interesting. I was talking to Professor Leipart, and he was saying that he, you know, doesn't actually support compulsory voting, but he supports people having to turn up. He liked a different terminology so that it was clear that you could turn up and not actually complete your ballot, but you had to actually turn up on the day and make some sort of a decision. And I think that happens in practice in Australia, doesn't it?
It's compulsory attendance that you have. When you turn up, you're given a ballot paper, you retire to the secrecy of the polling place, and you don't fill a ballot paper in. It's a secret ballot. There's no way they can work out afterwards if you did or didn't vote. There's various arguments about whether you have to, but certainly as there's been a slow creep of electronic voting into Australia, they've had to accept the fact that you can't force people to cast a formal vote. And so with electronic voting, they ask you, this vote is informal, is this what you intend? And they accept it. So there is an acceptance that you must turn up, but you don't actually have to vote for any of the candidates, and then you can cast an informal vote. It's just we tend to use the term compulsory voting, but really it's compulsory attendance.
That's right. That's what, obviously, I mean, that's why people can draw on the ballots or do whatever they like. Anthony, what do you see as the key challenges facing the Australian electoral system, and how do you think they could be addressed?
I'm not sure that they're facing the electoral system. I think that there's some institutional problems with upper houses. Our federal Senate is a good example. It is elected by proportional representation. It is a very powerful upper house. And there's been a growing tendency to move away from the concept of having governments having mandates when they win elections. So the whole concept of governments being perceived as having an ability to implement legislation they promised to introduce has been undermined slowly as the Senate as governments have lost control of the Senate. Some of those problems are caused simply by quite, this may sound like a very odd thing to say, but each of the states has equal representation in the Senate, and in a half Senate election, each of the states elects six members. Until 1984, it used to elect an odd number of members, and using proportional representation and an odd number of members and a droop quota, it's possible for a party to win a majority of the seats in a state, and therefore, from time to time, win a majority in the Senate. Since they adopted electing six, it has become almost impossible for either side of politics to ever win a majority. They have basically, by a simple change of the numbers of elected, they have made it a deadlocked Senate, which makes it very difficult for government to ever get close to controlling that Senate again. And that, I think, has created a bit of an institutional roadblock, which wasn't in the design of the Australian Constitution. There are mechanisms, we have a thing called a double dissolution, which allows, because the Senate is a permanent body and only half is elected every term, there's always the chance that it will be in conflict with the government in the lower house. And the mechanism was provided so that both houses could be dissolved together, called a double dissolution, on specific legislation. That has become a dead letter because the Senate now is no longer threatened by double dissolution because the quota is halved and because it's proportional representation and the slow diminution of the major party vote. It's not a threat for the Senate anymore. And so the Senate has become a bit of a plaything of oppositions. Oppositions encourage across benches to have their say in every bit of government legislation. So I'd say I think there is an issue to do with mandate, which has developed in Australia. Some of that is to do with our institutional structures, and some of that's to do with the electoral system. But I do think that somewhere along the line, something about that needs to be sorted out. Is that the way they want the electoral system to work in this country? And it requires changes to the Constitution, potentially, or changes to the number of members elected. Neither of those changes would be particularly popular, but I think it's something that needs to be addressed.
And one of the things that's come up in previous podcasts is this concept that seems to be doing the rounds, I guess, of a citizen Senate, where the Senate is no longer elected but is selected by lottery. Have you come across that, and what do you think about it?
It's going to be hard enough to change anything to do with the Senate, but to adopt a model like that just isn't going to be acceptable. I cannot imagine that the Australian public's going to vote for that. The Senate, as it's structured with equal representations from each of the states, was the absolute cornerstone of federation. Does this new Senate have the ability to bring down governments, which the current Senate does? Does it have the ability to block legislation? I'd want to see an awful lot more information. I think one of the problems is in the Australian constitutional structure is that both houses are co-equal in power. I can't see that having a co-equal Senate as some sort of citizens' representative in that sort of model is necessarily acceptable for a democratic functioning. I think it needs a lot more thought. I mean, I haven't heard much about the proposal, but I think it needs a lot of thought because, as it is, the Senate is a very powerful institution.
Yes, yes. Now, there's a lot of questions to be answered before it could go ahead. So you're definitely right there. Is there anything else that you'd like to cover off?
Yeah, one of the consequences of compulsory voting and full preferential voting is Australia has a very high proportion of what we call informal, other countries call spoiled ballot. Now, some of those spoiled ballots are just blanks. People, we don't know why, they've cast blanks, either don't like any of the options, they don't understand the instructions, but maybe a third to a half of all of our informal votes are blanks. In Australia, turn up and vote blank. In other countries, just wouldn't turn up. So that's one of the reasons we have a higher form of vote. The second is with full preferential voting, people simply make numbering errors, and our system is very, very unforgiving for people who make errors on their ballot papers. And I think that more votes could count if people weren't quite as obsessed about the numbering. Some of our states have optional preferential voting where you don't have to number squares, and they have lower rates of informal voting. And recently, the Senate system, which had what used to be an enormous informal vote, they introduced a form of ticket voting years ago, which was full preferential voting. But you voted for a party and the party determined the preferences. That had become so rorted in recent years that they had to get rid of that ticket voting system and they adopted a form of optional preferential voting for the Senate. That's been a huge step forward. We've only had one election under the new system yet. It's still to bed in. It's a normal half Senate election. But I think that was a step forward. But I do think that not enough people, there's a tendency to think if you can't fill in a ballot paper correctly, your vote shouldn't count. Well, I don't think that's right. People turn up and make an effort to vote, I think their vote should count to the extent that is possible to make it count. And I think in this country we throw away too many ballot papers just because of a little numbering error.
That makes sense. As part of my PhD, I was interviewing some local councillors and I was interviewing an ex-mayor in a Queensland council that doesn't have wards, just has all the, you know, say 8 or 10 councillors elected by everybody, I guess. And the interesting thing he said was that when you look at the actual cast ballots, generally speaking, people vote for the one person they know, give them number one, and then they just run down the rest of the ballot sheet, 2, 3, 4, in order that people appear. And so his view was that some of the ballots actually end up with people basically being elected, in a sense, almost just by chance, based on whatever position they get on the ballot sheet.
Yeah, I think full preferential voting made sense in the days when there's only 2, 3, or 4 candidates on a ballot paper. Last federal election, there were 16 candidates in one election. Nobody can possibly have an opinion on all those candidates. We had a by-election where there were 22 candidates once. The leading Liberal candidate had 56% of the vote, but they still checked all 73,000 ballot papers to ensure there was a correct sequence of 1 to 22, and not one of those preferences needed to count to determine the winner. So I think it's ridiculous that we do such bureaucratic checking just to make sure people have followed the rules, when you could relax the rules and people's real intents could be counted perfectly happily.
I think that's right. You've been involved with the introduction of Vote Compass here in Australia. Can you tell me what you identify as the main benefits and limitations of that system?
Well, people clearly enjoy doing it, and the main benefit from it is people like getting the questions, 30 questions, you know, on policy issues and then filling them in. And then Vote Compass gives them feedback on how much their answers to the policy questions aligned with party policies, how close they were to one party or the other. People quite enjoy that process. The limitation of it is that we know very well that most people don't vote on policy. People's views on policy often align with the party that they support. And what it also doesn't measure is, and this particularly comes up with people, Vote Compass tries to measure the difference between Green and Labor supporters, is that there's quite a few people who are Labor voters. And when they fill in Vote Compass, it'll say that they're closer to the Greens. Well, on their political attitudes, they may be, but they have a different attitude to how politics works. They may have idealistic views on policy, but they vote for a pragmatic party who can form government. They don't vote for an idealistic party that can't form government. And so Vote Compass is very poor at picking the difference in those types of voters. And we know that. That's not what the questions are asked about. We also know that essentially people still vote on party alignment, which is their preferred party. People who don't have particularly strong party alignment vote very strongly on attitudes towards the leader. So when you use a tool like Vote Compass and it's just working on the basis of party policy, it's only going to be a rough approximation of how people will actually vote, because what you really need to do is ask about identification, party identification, and attitudes to leader will be the two biggest determinants of voting. Now, the way that people align their policy positions with their preferred party means that Vote Compass still approximates that. But still, it's a useful tool, and it provides us with useful data on to break down demographically how people vote one way or the other. But because we take questions which differentiate between the two sides of politics, some of the analysis based on party is fairly obvious. So it's always interesting. Sometimes we do get a question, and you find that a particular party is more split on that result than the other political parties, and that's where you sometimes get some interesting findings.
I've certainly heard anecdotally that people find that the system, if you like, tells them that they align more with the Greens and they don't know, but I'm not voting for the Greens. You've suggested that primarily happens with Labor voters. Does the data show that Liberal voters tend to be more aligned with the party policies?
No, it's just a spectrum issue. Is that when you draw up the spectrum of left versus right, like the Liberals and Nationals are on one side, Labor's on the other, and Green is beyond Labor, is that people who are in the Labor Party want to push for further change, except that their party's going to form government and there'll have to be pragmatic choices. That doesn't mean they don't want to campaign for. There'll be lots of Labor voters who are very much stronger, much closer to the Greens on attitudes to, say, asylum seekers. But they understand that for their party to form government, their party's not going to be as close to their views, and they'll sort of bury that view. But that's just how politics works, and it doesn't affect the Liberal Party because there's nobody else. When we've set up Vote Compass, there's nobody on that side of politics, on the Liberal and National side, who might be bleeding votes. Perhaps when the next election we may well have One Nation on the spectrum. We may see a similar thing occurring. But I mean, essentially, it's occurring between Labor and the Greens. It's just simply that they're both on the same side of the political spectrum.
My interview with Anthony was recorded some time ago, and we are currently in the midst of a federal election here in Australia. And as Anthony suggested in his comments about Vote Compass, it has been extended to include the ultra-conservative party One Nation. It will be interesting to see the impact of a party to the right of the Liberal Nationals on where people's policy preferences align. I'll provide a link to the Vote Compass tool in the show notes. In the next episode, I'll be covering electoral systems in New Zealand. I hope you'll join me then.
Thanks for listening to Real Democracy Now! You can find more about today's topic in the show notes at www.realdemocracynow.com.au. If you enjoyed this program, please subscribe to this podcast, write a review, share the podcast with your friends, and join the conversation on the webpage or on Facebook or Twitter. I'd love to know what you think is the essence of a real democracy.